You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, August 27th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Kuta'a, which is Inuit for hello.
Hey, Evan, and happy birthday.
Oh, yeah, thank you very
birthday.
Much.
Happy birthday.
I don't know how to say that in Inuit. Inuit.
Isn't it Inuit? I think it's Inuit, not Inuit.
And doesn't Inuit encompass a huge number of different people? I didn't realize it was one language.
It's indigenous people inhabiting the Arctic regions of Greenland, Canada, and the United States and Russia.
Right. It can't really be considered, like, what I'm saying is that I don't think it's right to say, you know, you've just said good evening in Inuit, because I don't think that Inuit is one language. I think there are many languages that fall within what we would consider Inuit.
Well, Inuit is considered one language, but that's just for convenience. Within the Inuit language family, there are many dialects, some mutually understandable and then others not. And as you might imagine, the farther away you get from someone regionally, the less similar the languages are.
In any case, Kuta'a.
Okay. You know, now that I hear you say that again, it sounds a little bit like Klingon, right?
I thought it sounded
well, that word,
German. Sounds like Guten Tag.
Guten Tag.
Well, thank you for the happy birthday wishes. I appreciate that. I'm 43 for those of you interested. And hey, it's been a great 43 trips around the sun. I hope for at least 43 more.
Yeah, that'd be nice. That'd be a good run.
That'd be a good run. Mm-hmm.
But what a sad birthday to have marking the end of the passenger pigeon. That's right. In 1914, the passenger pigeon became extinct on this day, September 1st.
Passenger pigeon. Mm-hmm. There used to be a lot of those birds around.
I remember reading from when I was a kid that they would fill the skies, literally horizon to horizon.
It would take hours or even days for the largest colonies to pass overhead.
That actually sounds super annoying.
Oh, God.
That's a lot of poop.
Yeah, yeah, like, think right? about that.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that when
good
I was reading about it.
Passenger pigeon.
Yeah,
it's raining poop.
A certain romanticism for the passenger pigeon because they're extinct. But when you think about it, imagine if they were still around in their original numbers. 40% of all North American birds were passenger pigeons.
Whoa.
Wow.
They existed in these massive colonies.
Where?
And flocks just nesting over areas that were hundreds of miles, hundreds of square miles. They would be a nuisance if they were alive today. In
sure.
Anything.
We'd have to kill them.
Yeah.
But you know what's remarkable is so many pigeons hunted to extinction. I mean, that's a lot of hunting.
Yeah, well, we're a hungry people.
That's the thing that is amazing as well, the fact that they were hunted so tenaciously that in just several decades, they were driven to extinction. And at no point did somebody say, maybe we should ease off a little bit here. In fact, the last two sightings of passenger pigeons in the wild were shot.
Oh, America.
Wow. And when did that happen?
In 1899 and in 1900.
Although apparently us destroying their environment also had an impact.
Yes.
It was mostly hunting, but yeah. We killed them in a number of ways, really.
So they killed the last two and they said, don't worry, there'll be a lot more of those.
Yeah.
A lot more where they came from.
Did they ever put a number at their population at its height?
4 to 5 billion.
Whoa.
Ooh.
Now, were people eating these animals?
That's a lot of bird business, if you know
what
I'm talking
about. They were being eaten, yes.
And we don't have any genetic sample from them at all?
There's some stuffed examples. I don't know if it's possible to get DNA from them.
Actually, they do have DNA of them because they've shown apparently their relationship to the dove. To get back to that romanticization idea, I hate pigeons. Everybody lives in the city hates pigeons. They're
winged rats.
Yeah, they are disease-filled rodents with wings.
Why do people think that about pigeons? I mean, I think they're kind of cute. They make cute noises and, you know.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen one up close?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
They're covered in filth and bugs
no,
and
not.
They peck each other's eyes out for bits of a tourist bread.
What? That's the monkey. That's the monkey in you speaking, Rebecca.
Like, as if they're doing it with conscious intent.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Oh, they are. They are. Oh, yeah. That Animaniacs skit about the good feathers was totally. You know, that was like a documentary. The pigeons in Boston get super fat. Like, they are fat pigeons. They are no longer working for their meals. They just harass tourists into giving them food.
Who knows the name of the last surviving pigeon that died in the Cincinnati Zoo?
Billy Joe.
Fred.
Lucky.
Hippie Martha. Go sizzle. What?
Ah. Martha.
Martha.
Did you say hippie go sizzle?
Yes.
Did you know that the apparently the telegraph contributed significantly to the death of the passenger pigeon? Do you know how that was?
Because they were no longer wires. Needed to send messages?
No.
They'd run into the wires?
Because people would use the telegraph in order to communicate the location of colonies. Then the hunters would descend and wipe them out.
Oh, I was going to say that.
Wow. Technology is not good or evil. It's just how it's used.
Exactly.
Like the death ray.
Let's move on to our news items. We're starting with an in memoriam this week. Always sad. Neil Armstrong died a couple days ago.
Yeah.
End of an era.
On August 25th, he was 82.
Good age.
He has a good age. Yeah. Had a very interesting life.
Yeah, he was the right guy at the exact right time in the right place.
With the right stuff.
The right stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, he went on afterwards to teach, right, guys? And, you know, could you imagine having Neil Armstrong be one of your teachers after he was on the moon?
Yeah, that'd be cool. He was an engineer. He was a nerd. Here's a quote from him.
Geek.
He said, "A century hence, 2000 may be viewed as quite a primitive period in human history. It's something to hope for. I am, and never will be, a White Sox pocket protector nerdy engineer born under the second law of thermodynamics, steeped in the steam tables, in love with free body diagrams, transformed by Laplace, and propelled by compressible flow. As an engineer, I take a substantial amount of pride in the accomplishments of my profession."
Wow.
Yeah, cool. He's a nerd and proud. He's a proud nerd. Yeah. And he often, you know, was very humble. He hated getting all of the attention for being like the first man to step on the moon.
Sorry, that goes with the contract.
It
you know,
does,
you read
but
the fine
he said,
print.
You know, what about the 10,000 engineers who put me here? I'm just the guy who happened to be riding in the rocket, you know, very humble perspective to take.
Well, it is humble.
He earned that position.
It's true, but the amount of nerve, for lack of a better word, because I would just rather use the word balls.
Go Nets.
In order to strap yourself into a rocket, leave the planet, and put yourself at risk in all the ways that he knows. This isn't like a, you know, someone that's blindly pulling a mission off. Like, you know, he knows every detail. He understands all the systems aboard those vessels. Like, you know, the pilots of these spacefaring vessels know all the systems. They know everything.
That's not true, Jay. I'm pretty sure other people strapped him in.
But you get what I'm saying. He explicitly knows how dangerous it is. You know, he knew what the odds were. I think at one point he said that there was a 90% chance that he was going to make it. But that's a pretty significant chance that you're going to die. 10% is a...
Yeah, I wouldn't want to roll that die too often. Yeah.
No way.
Wouldn't want to roll it even once. One of my favorite stories with Neil Armstrong involved his crash while flying the Lunar Landing Research Vehicle on Earth. It was just a test vehicle. And go to YouTube and check it out. Just punch in LLRV and Armstrong. You'll see it. This thing is pretty amazing. He's coming down. This thing's almost ready to hit the Earth. Then he ejects out like moments, literally moments before it crashes. The thing hits the ground, a huge fireball. Then you see him kind of casually kind of float down. And then like just a little while later, he's like back in his office doing work like nothing happened. And one of the other astronauts came in, and he's like, "Dude, what are you doing here? Didn't you eject today and almost die?" He's like, he didn't even look up. He's like, "Yeah, you know," he just kind of like grunted at him. You know, I would have gone at the least. I would have gone to the NASA bar and just got totally drunk.
I mean, you mean the space bar?
The space bar. Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, but of course,
no. I prefer Astro Bar. Thank you.
That's exactly
space bar is something on your typewriter.
Yeah, that was the joke, you dummies.
I even got
I'm explaining
one.
It to Bob.
Not a good one.
you know, not only do these guys have to pretend to be that cool, they have to be that cool. You know,
really? Good pickup.
I really don't think, in order to pull off what they did and what the astronauts continue to do, like, you can't be faint of heart at all. You have to be like this, one of the hardest personality types of all time. Like, you know, when you saw in the Right Stuff, the part where they put him in that room and they try to make him bug out, you know, they keep them up for a few days and there's noises and whistles and lights on and off and all sorts of weird environmental situations that they put them in. I absolutely love that part of the movie. It's just for some reason.
I love that whole movie.
Yeah. The whole movie is fantastic.
Well, Neil Armstrong said there can be no great accomplishment without risk. No matter how you slice it, going to the moon was hugely riskful.
Yeah.
Riskful.
Riskful, that's full of risk.
That's a word.
Risky.
It was riskful.
Riskful business.
It was replete with riskitude.
Riskitudinosity. It was
risk-tastic. Something you may not know about Neil Armstrong is that there are few what are considered good photographs of him on the moon. There are a lot of blurry ones, you know, off in the distance, nothing he really posed for. Buzz Aldrin's images and his footprints, and those are the ones that kind of make the history books, you know, as far as the actual pictures that they actually use. You can kind of see Neil in the reflection of Buzz Aldrin's helmet in one of the more famous shots, but they say that's about as clear a picture as there is of him on the moon. So
that would have pissed me off. Like, what? I go to the moon and there's not one good picture for me to put on Facebook?
If you have any interest in conspiracy theorists, then they're going absolutely out of their gourds over Neil Armstrong dying because,
really?
He was getting ready to say something, right?
Yeah. A lot of them claiming that he was just about to blow the whistle on the whole moon landing hoax. And
of course he was.
Yep. And other people saying, no, I happen to know for a fact that he was racked with guilt his entire life and he was never going to blow the whistle. And he got pissed if anyone ever asked about it, because he was so racked with guilt. So yeah, they're very excited about it. And also there are a number of them that are comparing his death to the fact that Lance Armstrong, I guess, just got, he's like in a doping scandal or something. And yeah.
They stripped his titles.
And so, they're like, well, this week, Lance Armstrong died career wise. And then Neil Armstrong dies, literally.
What are the chances? Coincidence?
Yeah, this can't be a coincidence.
I think not.
There are a lot of them. They refer to it as like bad week for the Armstrong family. It's so weird. It's like, oh, they've got the same last name. So therefore, everything that happens in their lives must be related.
Oh. And their cousin Stretch had his arm pulled off in a terrible accident between two Dobermans. It was really terrible.
The dark underbelly of the human psyche.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Bob, tell me about a naked Darth Vader. Why is that image in my head?
I love when science news stories, they feel so compelled to throw in a Star Wars or I think maybe even more often a Star Trek reference to make you read it, right? And, well, it kind of worked because it kind of sucked me in. So here's one title from the Science Daily. New ways to fight bacterial infections. Naked Darth Vader approach could tame antibiotic-resistant superbugs. And this one's even better from Mail Online. The force is strong with these ones. Drugs that make superbugs as harmless as a naked Darth Vader offer hope of a cure.
I hate that title. It's so stupid. You know,
well, obviously these all came from the same press release, right? Like that's not something that a bunch of people independently came up with.
Oh, no. One of the quotes from one of the doctors who's the lead author, it came right from him and they just all jumped on.
Okay.
So yeah. So what's this all about? Well, researchers at the University of Montreal published a paper in the August 24th issue of Chemistry and Biology about a new way to neuter virulent bacteria. It's this really interesting idea. The idea is to disarm the virulence factors of nasty bacteria to make them about as harmless as the bacteria in the gut that we coexist with very well. Now, this is the quote from Dr. Christian Baer, and he's the lead author and a professor of at the Department of Biochemistry. He said, to understand this strategy, one could imagine harmful bacteria being like Darth Vader, and the anti-virulence drug would take away his armor and lightsaber. He had to throw in lightsaber there. I just thought that was just so goofy. Oh, well, so what are these virulence factors? In a nutshell, that's what makes bacteria harmful to organisms. And it's not just bacteria. Viruses have them, protozoa, even
even fungi use these things. And so these factors consist of molecules that are secreted, and what they do is they bind to proteins in host organisms. And these molecules, or lightsabers, if you will, they could do lots of different things, which is really, it's amazing how versatile they are. They could help colonize a host. They can help the bacteria or whatever evade an immune response. It helps them exit a cell. It helps them get nutrition from a cell. Lots of these different things. So what the researchers have done is to determine the very fine details about exactly how these virulence factor molecules bind to the host proteins. And the hope, of course, is that this could potentially allow them, you know, to stop all of that stuff from happening. And it's pretty awesome. It's one of the best new infection treatment strategies that I've heard of in a while. But of course, my first thought with this kind of stuff usually is, well, how long will it take for the bacteria to adapt? Because that's like the one of the main problems. And we know how effective they are at doing that. I mean, considering how fast they reproduce and how well they can exchange genetic code, you know, between the different species of bacteria, any advantage that we get over them is usually very short-lived. And the result, of course, is that we've got these superbugs that are becoming increasingly prevalent, and they pretty much just laugh, right, at our best antibiotics, because we've been essentially just accelerating their evolution. The good news here, though, is that the bacteria will most likely have a real hard time adapting or evolving strategies to counter this new technique. I wish they had some more detail as to exactly why, but the consensus seems to be that it seems likely that they will only be able to evolve resistance to this technique very slowly. And it's even possible, I guess, that because of the nature of these factors, the bacteria won't be able to deal with it at all. So in terms of these news items, Darth Vader may never be able to put on his armor or turn on his lightsaber ever again. And that would be pretty amazing.
Yeah, so what's the ETA on these? 5 years?
5 years.
Yeah, 5 years.
They
didn't even say that. They didn't really give too much of an estimate on when they think they'll be seeing this stuff.
All right, well, Rebecca, tell us about homeopathic candy.
Ah, yeah. It says zero calories, first of all. No.
Zero
actually not zero calories.
There's an interesting thing happening in the UK right now. The MHRA, which is the medicines regulator in the UK, has been undergoing this project in which they're attempting to completely redo all of the UK medicine legislation. Right now, apparently, it consists of hundreds of different pieces of legislation that, you know, some of which is contradictory. So this regulator is moving through all the legislation and attempting to consolidate it into one easy to understand piece of legislation. That's a great thing. However, it has the homeopathy purveyors terrified, because right now under UK law, it's actually technically illegal for people to sell homeopathy without a license. And that is how the vast majority of homeopathy is sold, just out on the shelf at a pharmacy or online or being sold by the phone. What the actual law says is that you have to have a license and you have to have a face-to-face consultation with the patient. So that would mean that really homeopathic medicine has to be given out by a qualified doctor, really. The actual medicine, quote-unquote, homeopathic medicine, would have to be licensed, and there are only 50 licensed homeopathic medicines right now. So the vast, vast majority of homeopathic remedies that are being sold in the UK right now are technically illegal. However, at this point in time, nobody is actually enforcing that law. But the homeopaths are concerned that once this review of the legislation is through, it's going to bring the heat on them, that this stuff is going to start. Once this is only one law of a few as opposed to one law of hundreds of contradictory laws, they're afraid that now it's going to start being enforced. So the candy reference was something that was spotted by a few skeptics, like my friend Martin Robbins, who wrote about it in The Guardian. This is just such a great quote. The homeopaths are trying to come up with ways that they can continue to sell their product if this law starts being enforced. This is what Helios Homeopathics Limited had to say as their response if this law starts being enforced. If necessary, we could revise the manufacturing method, the labeling of the bottles and kit box to present them, the medicine remedies, as non-medicines and non-homeopathic and market them as confectionery. Customers who have an interest in homeopathy would still know how to use them and would continue to purchase them despite limited labeling. There would, of course, be media repercussions and uncontrolled sources appearing and confusion among the public and MPs who would demand a full explanation for the change. This is an option which our customers would support if it ensured a continuation of the supply of kits until they are fully licensed. And like, that's great. Yes, that's like, to me, that's exactly what we've been asking for. Market your quote unquote homeopathic remedies as candy. It's not actually medicine. If you want to sell it as candy next to the candy cigarettes and the Swedish fish, that is absolutely fine.
Well, we've made fun of this before. This very point is that you could potentially get away with something like that.
Yeah.
You know, to the detriment of
everyone. But as long as you don't make any health claims about it.
Right.
Oh, sure. Right. No specific.
Do you think people would still buy it though if it were in that candy aisle?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think they've got enough, you know, enough people already know about homeopathy.
They've already established the market.
Yeah. There's enough stuff on the internet making the claims for them. You know, often we talk about organizations that use people on the internet making claims so that they don't have to make the actual claims, you know, so they're not actually held liable for the claims.
Yeah.
So I think that's the way it would continue to be for homeopathic remedies, but this would be a way of mocking them. It would leave them open to a lot of criticism, and
it would marginalize them a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good word for it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, anything that keeps fraud and nonsense from being mainstreamed and having deception right on the pharmacy shelf, you know.
Yeah.
Unsuspecting people going in and go, I need a cold remedy. Here's a cold remedy. They take it off the shelf. They don't notice that it says homeopathic underneath, which is basically like saying, this is a fraud that doesn't work. And, you know, they don't notice or they don't know what homeopathic means. They think it means natural or herbal or whatever. So, you know, people are buying products based upon false claims, false marketing with the incorrect idea of what it is. And this is all done in the name of consumer choice. When in fact, the real purpose of it is to legalize defrauding the public with false claims.
Can't say it better than that, Steve. That really sums
it
up.
What if candy makers just started labeling their candy as homeopathic remedies? I'm suggesting to candy companies, just call your stuff homeopathic remedies at this point. You know, cures a sweet tooth. You know, there you go.
Evan, you're going to tell us about people who hear voices.
Have any of you at any time in your lives ever thought you might be hearing voices, maybe when you were younger?
Sure.
Yep.
Yeah. When I get really tired.
Yeah. When I'm falling asleep, like really overtired, I might hear like a single word or.
Yeah, or like whispering. Yeah.
That's hypnagogia though. It's kind of like a waking dream.
You always call anything weird hypnagogia.
No, I call hypnagogia. Thank you very much.
Yeah, the audio form of hypnagogia, that's right. I've experienced the same thing. But have you ever just been kind of fully awake, either at work or, you know, at school, sitting in front of your computer or whatever, driving in the car, and voices, you know, start talking to you out of nowhere? Well, in a recent article from The West, that's a Western Australian news agency, they report that 5 to 10% of people down under of various age groups admit to hearing voices. So we're not talking about the hypnagogia version that we just talked about. We're talking about people who are walking down the street, part of their everyday life, and they believe that there are people talking to them, yet there's no one else around. There's an organization called Hearing Voices Network Australia, HVNA. According to them, taking into account all voice hearing experiences, only a small number of voice healers experience what could be called distressing or debilitating voices, but others describe what they hear as spiritual, cultural, psychic, positive, everyday experience. And it ranges. I mean, some people hear male voices and Other people hear female voices, or some people hear familiar voices, friendly voices, unfamiliar voices, angry, cool. It runs the spectrum of the kinds of voices that people have reported to be hearing. And this relates back to a study that was published just this year from Ireland, talking about the phenomenon of hearing voices. And they found out that it can affect more than 20% of young adolescents. Researchers with the HRB, that's the Health Research Board in Ireland, discovered auditory hallucinations has an impact on 21 to 23% of children that they researched in Ireland from the ages of 11 to 13. More than half of those children who had heard voices, 57% of them, were also found to have a psychiatric disorder following clinical assessment. Now, for many of the children, the phenomenon would stop as they progressed through their teenage years. So by age 16, of those children who, when they were 13, said they heard voices, about three-quarters of them, the phenomenon just goes away by itself. But for an unfortunate 25% left over, they still have the condition. The condition persists. Now, of those who reached age 16 hearing the voices, 80% of them had a psychiatric disorder. So what this study does is it links auditory hallucinations and mental illnesses.
For younger kids, though, when you ask them about hearing voices, I mean, how much of that is that? Do they just go on self-reporting? Like, how do you tell the difference between someone who's actually literally hearing voices and someone who's attention-seeking or using their creativity?
That's a good question. I hope that they had some kind of a standard operational definition, a questionnaire or some specific features that it wasn't just anyone self-reporting, but they had to say it in a certain way or endorse certain features of it. I don't know. It'd be interesting to look at those details. There's a lot of really fascinating aspects of this phenomenon. The whole, you know, there's a hearing voices movement, which was started in 1987. And this is an attempt to move the notion of hearing voices away from a mental illness. Now, there are some legitimate aspects of this movement, but it does flagrantly go into, I think, the realm of psychiatry or mental illness denial. And they're very anti-psychiatry. And, of course, they also are buddying up to holistic alternative medicine as well. Yeah, so they get into that realm. So here is the position, the summarized position of the movement. Hearing voices is not in itself a sign of mental illness. That's one. That's one of those things that's true, but I think that they completely misinterpret the significance of that. Most medical signs are not in and of themselves necessarily pathological, and most signs can occur in the healthy population. We talked about hypnagogia or sleep paralysis. Sleep paralysis is a sign of narcolepsy, but occurs in 15% of the non-narcoleptic, you know, normal population. Does that mean it's not a sign of narcolepsy? No, it just means that it can also occur in people who don't have it. Or muscle twitching, just to take something non out of the, you know, the neuroscience realm. Muscle twitching is a sign of ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, but it also occurs by itself as in a benign form that's not a sign of a pathological condition.
Is it like a was it a myoclonic twitch?
No, that's different. I'm talking about benign fasciculations. Myoclonus is a different phenomenon altogether. So it's identical to the fasciculations that occur with ALS, but there's no ALS. It just occurs by itself. So that's true of just so many things. The fact that people who don't have mental illness can be hearing voices doesn't mean that hearing voices isn't an indicator of a possible mental illness. But like Evan was saying, it has to go along with other signs of mental illness before we consider it part of schizophrenia, for example, or a specific mental illness. Here's another part of their position. Hearing voices is experienced by many people who do not have symptoms that would lead to the diagnosis of mental illness. Okay, like we just said, true, but who cares? Hearing voices is often related to problems in life history. So they're trying to say that it's like a very Freudian notion that it's related to unresolved traumatic or childhood issues. I'm not sure why they favor that explanation. They're just trying to say like it's not like a problem. It's not a real mental illness like schizophrenia where there's some flaw in the brain wiring or brain chemistry. It's just people who had stressful events happen to them earlier in their life and now it's manifesting as voices. Okay, maybe that's some people, but you know, But a lot of people also have schizophrenia. They also have, you know, a more hardcore mental illness that of which this is just one symptom.
So the whole movement is based on just denying these facts?
I think it's really core to the movement. So again, I think the kernel of legitimacy is that, yes, hearing voices is not universally part of a mental illness. There are a lot of people who do not have mental illness who just have an isolated phenomenon of hearing voices. And hearing voices is part of a huge spectrum. There are some people who might, the voices may be benign. They don't bother them. For some people, the voices say very positive and uplifting things. It's actually a pleasant experience for them. Okay, good for them. But in other people, the voices are negative or confrontational. Some people feel like the personalities or the agents behind these voices are stronger or more powerful than they are, and they're very distressed, and it causes them a lot of negative consequences. So like mental illness in general or mental disorders, we define it not only by the existence of something like this that's out of the ordinary for individuals, but that it has to cause some problem for the person. If it's not causing a problem, okay, then it's not a mental illness or it's not a disorder. There are people who hear voices and it's a pleasant experience. It doesn't bother them and they don't need to be treated. I completely get that. But if that were the limit of their point, like we shouldn't just knee-jerk treat everybody who hears voices as if they have a mental illness and give them powerful, you know, antipsychotic drugs to stop the voices as if the voices by themselves are a problem. Right, I get that. That is a narrow and inappropriate kind of old school approach that we need to get away from. We need to understand that voices are a much more complicated phenomenon, but that doesn't mean it's not also part of a mental illness and is not a marker of that. And it should not be used as a way of gauging how people are doing or their response to treatment or whatever. So they just went too far, you know, with that whole notion.
Steve, do you think a plank also in their platform might be sort of an anti-drug?
Yes, it's anti-psychiatry, anti-drug, pro-natural healing approach to it. So they get into that whole thing as
well. Steve, are these also parents that are trying to say positive things about their children that have problems? You think that's the bulk of the population here?
No, I don't think so. I think that that's not the core of the movement. I think the core is what I just said, but that might also attract parents who like don't want to, you know, accept the notion that their child has mental illness. And again, it may be too early in a teenager to really say. Again, a lot of teenagers will grow out of it, you know, according to the data. The other really interesting aspect of this is what's going on in these people's heads? Well, just completely separate question. What is going on in the brains of people who are hearing voices?
Who don't have a definable mental illness, you mean?
Who do or don't. I'm not even, you know, it may be more than one phenomenon. It may not be the same phenomenon, but I'm very interested in what's the malfunction in the brain. So, and what is the phenomenon? There's lots of different ways you can think about it phenomenologically. Is it that they can't distinguish certain thoughts in their brain as thoughts arising internally from themselves, and they're misinterpreting them as voices coming from other agents? Is this a problem of consciousness? In other words, when we interviewed Bruce Hood at TAM, the concept of consciousness came up, and you know, he noted that one of the possible reasons that we are conscious of our own stream of consciousness, you know, that we're not these pea zombies or philosophical zombies that are not aware of our own existence, is that we need to distinguish things that are happening in the present from memories. And maybe that's part of a bigger phenomenon, that we have to be able to distinguish voices that we're hearing from things we're remembering from things we're thinking. These are all related phenomena happening in the brain. And we need to know what's happening here and now in the world and what are just thoughts and memories. And maybe there's a breakdown of that ability to cleanly separate these different kinds of things, leading to thoughts being interpreted as voices that are happening here and now. And of course, they're not coming from anywhere, so you're just hearing voices. Or it may just be a breakdown in some brain network or module where, like when we have a breakdown in reality testing and you can't tell what's real and what's fantasy, here you can't tell what's a thought or a memory versus what is a voice happening in real time in the real world. Which is interesting because schizophrenics have both of those phenomena. They both hear voices and have breakdown in reality testing. Maybe that's why they have both, because they're that. Maybe the same module is missing and resulting in both. Who knows? It's really fascinating to try to understand how the different networks in the brain interact with each other and produce things that we take for granted, like, again, distinguishing memories from things happening in real time.
Steve, could these voices be spirits from another dimension that are, you know, tunneling in through like a space-time warp and actually projecting themselves metaphysically in this person's head?
Well, Jay, brings us back to the movement, you know, to the hearing voices movement, because also part of their movement is to say people have their own interpretation of where these voices are coming from, and they're all valid. Mm-hmm. If people think that they're spiritual or psychic or interdimensional aliens or whatever, who are we to challenge their interpretation of their own voices and blah, 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 postmodernist bullshit, blah, blah, blah. You know, so. Yeah, it's like, you know, reality and truth don't really matter. It's people can just think whatever they want about their own voices. Yeah, but I want to understand what's actually going on. It certainly sounds like a neurological phenomenon to me. And like most neurological phenomena like this, there's a spectrum from neurotypical, you know, okay, I'll buy into that concept to some degree. And then things that are outside of the typical, but not necessarily a disorder or pathological. And then you take it farther and farther and you get to actual disorders and then maybe even full-blown mental illness, where people are dysfunctional, their brain's not working, and it's causing serious life problems. That's fine. That spectrum exists, but don't deny the extremes, you know, because there's a spectrum, right? The false spectrum logical fallacy.
And be careful where you go for help, because I plugged in hearing voices and help on the internet, and it brings you to a lot of, you know, good things to read, but there's a lot of crap in there as well. A 14-year-old girl posted a question on Yahoo Answers saying, I'm a 14-year-old girl. I sometimes hear voices whispering into my ear, and someone gets on there and replies, oh, don't worry about it. You know, it's all paranormal.
Yeah.
You should embrace it.
Well, there's
it
that entire sci-fi show, Psychic Kids. I think it's on Sci-Fi. I apologize to Sci-Fi if it's not.
It's on A&E TV.
Thank you. Okay. So on A&E. Yeah, and they throw these kids on television and they tell them that they have psychic powers and that they're literally talking to dead people. And instead of saying, oh, well, you know, this is a known phenomenon and we have ways to deal with this, I find it to be just the most horrific TV show.
It is. It's child abuse and it's malpractice. Yeah. Anytime you're interpreting a mental illness as a psychic or paranormal phenomenon, the same thing comes up with demonic possession. You know, it's like saying they're possessed by real demons and it's not a mental disorder.
And
it's the same thing.
Take your medication and the demons will go away.
Yeah, for a while, yeah.
Yeah, or we'll put you in a burlap sack and beat you with these sticks.
Yeah, every year I feel like we have at least one story of some teenager being killed, you know, through an exorcism or because they were told they were a witch, you know, which we've talked about recently on the show.
Yeah, it's terrible. And A&E should be totally ashamed of themselves. Well, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Thank you, Stephen Novella.
You're
and
welcome,
this week,
Evan.
Oh, I appreciate that. This week.
Oh, Evan, did I say happy birthday?
You did. Well, say it again, why don't you?
Okay. Again, why don't you?
Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
This week,
Evan, how old are you?
In dog years or
picoseconds?
In light years.
Oh God!
Kessel run.
In parsecs. How old are you in parsecs?
George Lucas is rolling over in his grave. Well, his career is. Now then, last week's Who's That Noisy for all of you to listen to one more time. Jay, are you ready on your end?
And here we go.
Ah, yes, yes. A noisy that many people answered correctly to.
Yeah, anything from YouTube is going to, I think, attract a lot of correct answers.
Yeah, especially one of the more popular. It's not quite iconic, I wouldn't say, but this one I know has gotten a lot of views. 12 million, in fact, according to today's number. Nice. 12 million people. So some of those happen to be SGU listeners as well, and they were the ones who answered correctly. This clip is titled, Cat Gets Caught Barking by a Human and Resumes Meowing. So the part you didn't hear in that clip, obviously, is when the cat turns around to find out it's being recorded by its owner, it suddenly goes from barking to meowing, as if to say, oh, you're here, ape-like creature, and I have to be a cat again.
So was he trying to frame the dog for something? Is that what was going on?
I don't know what context, if that's the whole context. The clip itself is only 20, you know, the entire clip is only 20 seconds long, so it doesn't give you much to go on from the get-go. But the cat is looking out a window, looking at something. Apparently it's got its interest. And it's making some kind of noise at whatever it is it's directing its noises towards. And it whatever it is, it must want it to think it's a dog for some reason. Maybe it's another cat trying to scare another cat away. Very clever, if you ask me.
All right, cool. The barking
cat. Yeah, lots
cat.
Of people got, yep, lots of people got that correct. The first one to get correctly from the message boards, the night janitor. He only has two posts up. This is his second post. And here it is in its entirety. Who's that noisy is barking cat? Regards, night janitor. So,
very pithy.
Thank you for keeping us tidy at night there, night janitor.
All right, and what do you got for this week?
All right, here we go. Without further ado, this week's Who's That Noisy? Spot the voice.
It's a lot to take in. You know, I mean, werewolves, ghosts, vampires. I didn't even believe in homeopathy before this. Sure.
I thought she properly put homeopathy in its proper context in that clip, if you ask me. So, info@theskepticsguide.org is our email address, and sguforums.com is our forums. Please give us your answer, best guess, or your worst guess. It's up to you. Good luck, everyone.
Thank you, Evan. All right, well, Jay, you are going to give us a special report about a conspiracy conference.
Yeah, a listener to the show emailed me and let me know that he and his wife had gone to it can only be best described as a conference filled with people that were talking about all of their different conspiracy theories. He decided, even though it was going to be very expensive, I think it was over $1,000 each, so he spent over $2,000 to get there. Yeah, it was,
what?
It was.
That's dedication.
Well, wow.
Well, wait, that was everything now. That was $180 for the entrance fees, and then he had to do hotel, meals, rental car, airfare,
oh, okay.
And everything. Right.
That wasn't the registration fee by itself.
No, but still, it's a lot of money to spend on something to go and just basically be a fly on the wall. He wanted to do some investigative reporting on this. So we met up on Skype and we talked for quite a while about the whole thing. And then at the end of it, after quizzing him and asking him questions and trying to pull out interesting information, he said, I got to tell you, Jay, we haven't even scratched the surface because I think he had hours of audio that he recorded every time he was talking to someone. He was very careful to not get caught, but he had an audio recorder in his pocket.
So what you're telling me, Jay, is that nobody at this conspiracy conference picked up the fact that they were being secretly recorded by somebody who infiltrated their conference.
No, and I got to tell you, after working with him and putting together this information, there are some twists and turns in this story that I found not only surprising, but a little shocking. He said there was about 350 people attending. It was about half male, half female. He said lots of minorities, very few people under 40 years old. You know, his basic take on it were that the people were genuinely nice. Like, they seemed to be friendly people, very talkative, very interested to talk to everyone else that was there. So I was asking him about if they were careful about not letting people like him in, because I had read previously that conventions like this are on the lookout for spies and for people that are going to do any negative reporting. So he said before the convention started that they were walking around, he and his wife, checking out the hotel, taking in the area where the convention was going to take place. And then he came upon a room and he overheard a speech being given by someone that he later found out was one of the organizers to a bunch of the volunteers. And the guy said, keep an eye out for the media, people with recorders and cameras, and anyone not like-minded to our cause. And this was all the night before the conference started, which, you know, of course, is very funny to hear them just say it just like that. I guess they get harassed. I guess there was a lot of incidents of...
Yeah, but also, Jay, they might just be saying that because they know that's what their people want to hear.
Yeah, that's true. They are conspiracy theorists.
That's right. That's their bread and butter. Things get interesting here. This is the summary of the people that were there, and I'm going to expand on what I said previously. He said early in the convention, he noticed that there was a fundamental baseline paranoia that the attendees and the presenters had in general as it relates to their daily living. And he said that a typical thing or impression that he got was the always be looking over your shoulder statement. You know, all of them are always pushy about, you have to be careful. There's always something going on. There's always a conspiracy happening right there, wherever you are. He said they were all blatantly narcissistic and full of themselves, and that they all felt that they were so much smarter and, in quotes, in touch with what was going on around them, and that the general public, and he said that they thought the general public was a bunch of lemmings, and they referred to them as lemmings. That was like one of the words that he kept hearing.
So far, this sounds exactly like a skeptics meeting, but okay, go on.
That's what he said. Oh. You know, he made that observation too. He pointed that out. I think it was an interesting moment in our conversation because, you know, if you think about it, when you're going to a convention of like-minded people, you're with your people, you know, with the people that you're identifying with and that you typically think of it as an us or them situation. But it was a little humbling too to hear them say that. And there's even more. So let me continue and you'll really get the picture here. What's going on? He said that, it was fascinating to listen to these people talk about themselves being the critical thinkers. And he quotes this, skeptics are just cynics who are blinded by their preconceived notions and ignore the facts around them. And they consider themselves to be the open-minded and logical group. And they view the skeptical community as having the exact same flaws in logic as the skeptics view the conspiracy community. And he jokingly said that it was like they were in a parallel but opposite universe because there was a lot of very similar language as to what we use talking about them, which is very ironic.
We both can't be right.
He said similar to our conferences, they would invite people to come up and ask questions after a speaker had talked. And one guy walked up and asked the speaker how he could bring around his skeptic friends to their way of thinking. The speaker says, be honest, don't belittle, be respectful, and little by little, the skeptic will come out around to the truth. What does that sound like?
Wow.
Seriously, guys, isn't that interesting? That same questioner said that he had joined a skeptical group in Southern California and was working to bring them around. And my guy on the inside said that he almost broke out laughing at that point and got busted. It was really difficult for him not to lose it at that point. It's funny as both of our groups are in a way trying to find out more and infiltrate the other group. Take that for what it's worth. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm not saying anything like they're right or whatever, which of course they're not saying that about us either. But it is interesting that we're falling prey to similar, you know, feelings of knowing that we're right, everyone else is wrong and all that type of stuff. So, you know, if anything, you could be humbled a little bit by the idea that even the people that we're dead sure are wrong or feel the same exact way about us as we do about them.
Well, I mean, that's just generic though. Everyone thinks they're right.
Yeah, this is in no way surprising to me so far.
Rebecca, you're a worldly conference goer and you've been around the block a million times. I mean, you know, maybe a lot of our listeners may not have had as much experience. And even still, I mean, I've been doing this for 16 years and I was a little taken aback by his observations because they're true, you know, because it's true and it's interesting. He heard a weekend's worth, of course, the complete scientific nonsense. All of our scientific terminology, quantum mechanics, logical fallacies, you know, all recklessly built on top of each other like a house of cards. He said they just were throwing this stuff out left and right and everybody believed everybody else's nonsense. Then another thing that he noticed was subtle anti-Semitism from every single speaker that got up. And worse, the crowd and the vendors were not even trying to hide it. He heard different versions of the phrase, the Jews control the world and we need to stop them, over and over again. Just openly putting down the Jewish community as the, you know, the people that are in control and that are the troublemakers of the world. Other common threads that they observed by the attendees, he said everyone they spoke to, like I said, was very friendly, easy to approach. Everyone was eager to share their particular conspiracy and they were clamoring to hear his. You know, they were just very excited about everything that he was saying, which I found interesting. It wasn't just them wanting to talk their stuff. They were eating up all of his stuff. And he is actually a physicist that works on high-powered microwave and RF weapon design. He pretended to be in big fear of smart meters. I don't know if you guys know what smart meters are. these are the upgrades that the electric company uses to track your electricity usage, right?
Oh.
So they think that the smart meters are a big conspiracy of the government trying to listen in on what's happening in our own homes.
Wow.
Wow.
Another interesting thing he said was, common statement was, I don't have proof, I'm just asking.
That's the conspiracy. That's their modus operandi.
I asked him to give me a list of topics that were represented at the conference.
JFK, come on, JFK.
So the first thing that he said was, just to give me a little more information about what he was looking at as he's walking through and talking to all those people.
I'm putting my nickel down on chemtrails, by the way. Just want to get that down.
Safe bet.
I said JFK.
He said each speaker had a table that where they were selling books, videos, CDs, etc., which, you know, is not surprising. He said there were about 40 to 50 other vendors there. It was a very vendor-heavy event, selling books, videos, CDs, trinkets, food supplements. And here's his quick list that he gave me. UFO, psychic readings, tarot cards, anti-vax proponents, anti-fluoride proponents, aura photos, scams, global warming denial, chemtrails, smart meters, yes, microwave weapons, cell phone anti-radiation stickers to protect yourself against, mm-hmm, of course, spiritual consultants, monatomic gold supplements. What's that, guys?
I don't know.
Well, mono means one, atomic means
the gold equivalent atomic of colloidal silver, I guess.
That's what I assumed. I didn't figure that one out. Ear candling, moon hoaxers. He said that it was actually a ton of fun to talk to these people because they were so energized about the stuff that they were talking about, and he said it was fascinating to just listen to them go. So I asked him to list the best things that he encountered. The first thing he mentioned was the smart meters, and part of that is because he is very well versed in it. So he really was able to understand how off base they were and how little they actually knew about the whole thing. He said that, that smart meters are being used in many communities for electricity and gas reading, right? So these utilities are replacing the old style analog meters with these super up to date smart meters. And these meters maybe they're a little scary for the people to see. They actually look like an electronic device and everything. He said that they have a microprocessor and a clock that tracks the consumption. That's it. That's all they do. And they are also RF devices. So the meters don't even need to be walked up to. The guys just need to drive their cars down the street, and their cars will pick up all the readings from all these meters. So it just saves time and energy. Eventually, you know, especially with when the Wi-Fi network gets more prolific, or if they can hook these into the internet, no one would even have to drive past your house to read them. But the conspiracy people know better. These meters are actually a government plot to perform mind control and pacify the citizens via RF energy and monitor your speech and actions inside your own home. They even listen to you having sex. That's what they're there to watch.
So Jay, tell me that there was a vendor selling tinfoil hats.
He didn't say that, and I wish I could say that he did, but he didn't mention that. He said, here's other things that the smart reader people were saying. JFK invented global warming back in 1960 to begin the now New World Order.
Huh. Invented global warming. Yep.
Solar and wind energy was invented to control the weather and cause warming and droughts to control the population. He said that there are two kinds of physics. Prepare yourselves. Ready? There's Jewish physics, which was invented by Einstein. This is just a misinformation campaign to confuse the public. Okay?
Straight out of Germany in 1933. That's awesome.
Then there's Aryan physics, invented by Stanley Kubrick, Carl Sagan, and Arthur C. Clarke.
What?
This is hyperdimensional physics. This is how the universe really works.
Stanley Kubrick got in on it? Really?
Yep.
Then there was Carl Sagan, two of my heroes.
Oh, yep.
Right? Man. Yeah. Well, Clark, I mean, you know.
Three of my heroes.
All right, guys. AIDS denial. This is another government hoax. What was really appalling was the fact that the speaker was a real medical doctor at a real university hospital.
Oh, Jesus.
9/11 truthers. A guy said that the aircraft that crashed into the towers were holograms.
Yeah.
The aircraft were holograms.
Yeah.
They were placed
there. That's a powerful hologram.
They were placed there by military stealth aircraft flying at offset parallel path and projected the image as they flew through New York. And of course, when he says stealth, he really means cloaked like Star Trek, because the aircraft were actually invisible.
That's right. So much so that the 400 cameras that each took photo, you know, video of what was going on that day all saw the exact same thing.
Evan, they're cloaked. They're cloaked ships. And these ships, the technology, we got this technology from the aliens from the Roswell Area 51 situation.
Ooh, it all starts to fit together.
Yep.
I wonder what he projected the holograms off.
The holograms were being sent via invisibly cloaked ships.
I know, but that's bizarre, and so is just the whole idea of projecting a hologram onto what? You need something to reflect the hologram
Bob,
off
of. You clearly don't get where this is coming from. I mean, seriously, Bob.
Yeah, Bob,
catch
you
up,
and your
please.
Jewish physics.
The subtleties of holograms are escaping you. Move on.
So my guy, the skeptic that was there, wanted to know why the guy that was saying this was still alive. Because, you know, he was on to their elaborate hoax. The guy said, the Illuminati likes me because I am so smart and clever to have figured this out that they use my innovative ideas to perpetrate other acts against the people.
Wow.
Right.
I'm not done. I'm not done, guys. I'm sorry. I know this is going on long, but there's more information I have to give you.
There's a line there. I mean, you know, it's hard to, you know, it's not politically correct to dismiss somebody's ideas as being a product of dysfunctional neurology. But, you know, there's a line you get past where that's really the only meaningful way to make sense of certain opinions.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think part of it too, Steve, is that if they're in this culture, it just becomes the norm to them. You know, I think most of these people don't actually have raving emotional problems. I think they just get so steeped in it that it just doesn't seem strange to them anymore. So he was speaking to a woman who detailed how life came on Earth. And she said, we are all a collection of 12 warring tribes of aliens. The Illuminati, the Anokai, reptilians, greys, Octurians, Nordics, and other lesser species who reseeded the Earth every 26,000 years. We're all superhuman beings capable of incredible powers but are kept under control by the media and the government. There's a moon base in the hollow center of the moon where all the control is done. The master control station for the universe is on a base inside Phobos. And by the way, zombies are real and they are the result of not achieving sovereignty from the 12 warring tribes.
God, I hope that's true.
Okay. Did you ever hear of Cenomix? We've actually talked about this.
No. Cenomix.
It's aborted human fetuses ground up and dried, used for flavor enhancement in Pepsi, Campbell's soup, and Frito-Lay products.
Did the FDA approve that?
So, the moon hoax guy is convinced that 2001 A Space Odyssey was a test case film for Kubrick to fake the moon landing, while Arthur C. Clarke was a NASA employee to ensure the video would be convincing.
Heard that somewhere before.
9/11 was planned in 1967, and episode 23, season 2 of Get Smart laid the groundwork to see how well it worked.
Get
he
smart.
Heard that. Yes.
Get Smart, really. I feel like somebody's having a go here. Like,
yeah, right?
Somebody
we've just passed
somebody
into the
was
onion
onto this
realm.
Guy, and they're like, let's mess with him.
Let's take it all the way.
Now, just keep in mind, guys, this was the skin of the apple. Like he was literally like, Jay, I'm telling you like the stuff that I remember. I'm telling you like not even the best stuff. Like it was just the stuff that we could cover in like the hour and a half that we talked. I'm fascinated by this. I can't tell you how intrigued I am by conspiracy theorists now, especially after reading this. And I knew a lot about conspiracy theories before this, but this really pushed it in a direction for me. I'm going to do more research on these.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun in the way that, you know, listening to Coast and stuff like that is a lot of fun, except for all the anti-Semitism and health misinformation. If it weren't for all that, it sounds like it'd be a blast. Like the 50s.
Yeah, but it's from an investigative perspective, you know, there are reasons why I believe there are a lot of reasons why people become attracted to conspiracy theories and why they relate to them. And that's an interesting thing to do a deep dive on. But even, you know, the whole anti-Semitism aspect of this is also pretty interesting. I mean, those roots, I suspect, go way, way back in global culture. And I'd like to learn more about that.
About 5,500 years.
Yeah. And I mean, it's always been the Jews. And even when it's somebody else that the conspiracy theorists are claiming has taken over the world, it's usually code for the Jews. You know, they're talking about the Bilderbergs or the lizard people, you know, although, you know, David Icke may possibly actually mean lizard people, but also probably Jews. I mean,
I like calling him Icky.
Yeah, it's always the Jews. It's always been the Jews.
So that concludes my special report. I hope you guys liked it.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. We have a theme this week, a monosyllabic theme. The theme is fat. Fat. Mm-hmm. Lipids. Adipose. Ready?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here we go. Item number one. Recent research suggests that good and bad dietary fat is determined by their effect on gut bacteria. Item number two. According to recent research, those with normal BMI but significant belly fat are at higher risk of cardiovascular death than those in the obese range of BMI. And item number three. Researchers find that limiting TV viewing time is an effective strategy for weight reduction in adults and children. Bob, go first.
Okay, good and bad dietary fat. The worst place to have fat is in your gut because the fat just goes through all your having it all around in your gut is so much worse than anywhere else because it just because it really impacts your cardiovascular health. So I can kind of see there's a relationship with the gut bacteria. Possibly. The second one, this one's interesting. So you've got normal BMI, body mass index, but, so your weight's good, but you've got belly fat. And apparently this is saying that you're at higher cardiovascular risk than if you were in the obese range of BMI. Oh man, that's a really tricky one. Limiting TV viewing is an effective strategy for weight reduction. Well, yeah, I mean, that's just so obvious, it might be too obvious. See, if you're watching, if you're sedentary for hours a day, watching TV, then yeah, that's going to impact your any weight reduction strategy. So I think I'm just going to go with that one. It's just I can't imagine that not being right. So it's between one and two. So let's see.
This is the part of the show where you give me your answer.
All right, I'm going to go with the gut bacteria is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
All right, I'm going to pick number three. Random number generator has picked number three.
Which is which one?
The limiting TV viewing.
All right, Rebecca?
Well, surprisingly, that's the way I was leaning towards the TV one as well. So I might end up GWRNG today. Okay, so the good and bad dietary fats is determined by their effect on gut bacteria. Are you saying that whether they are good, whether the fat is good or bad is... Like the gut bacteria determines whether or not the fat is good or bad.
That's correct.
Okay. That's just a really weirdly written sentence.
It's hard to condense it down, but yeah, it's.
My problem with this one is, okay, gut bacteria, I think, is known to have very interesting, very dramatic effects on the rest of the body in a number of ways. And so I have no doubt in my mind that the way your gut bacteria processes what you eat can help determine your health, including, you know, how much fat sticks around, whatnot. Those with a normal BMI but significant belly fat are a higher risk of cardiovascular death. This is not a new idea. BMI doesn't describe placement of your fat, distribution of fat, I guess. And for that reason, BMI is a generally good resource for determining your health, but not by any means a great one. Saying that it has a higher risk of cardiovascular death, that's very specific and I can't say for sure. However, that does make sense to me. So that leaves this last totally obvious sounding thing, limiting TV viewing time as a strategy for weight loss in adults and kids. That seems like it should be right, because we know that being sedentary is a huge, huge, huge factor in determining your overall health. And in fact, I just saw something about how truck drivers have is one of the most dangerous jobs in part because of how sedentary you are. But that it just seems too obvious. So yeah, after all that, I'm going to GWRNG. Gonna go with the random number generator.
All right. And Evan.
Good fat, bad fat. Gotta have fat in the diet. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. Is it determined by their effect on gut bacteria? That's an interesting concept. Rebecca, you were kind of thinking along what I was thinking as well, how gut bacteria plays a big old role, and we're learning more and more about gut bacteria. I'm hoping that this BMI one is the fiction. Those are the normal BMI, but significant belly fat. Is it possible to have a normal BMI and significant belly fat? I didn't even know that that was really even possible. It's just it's because it's all concentrated there. Like the rest of you could be totally cut and you just have...
Or just lanky.
An alcohol gut, yeah. Or something like
that. You could be tall and lanky with a gut.
It's interesting.
Yeah, see it all the time.
It's interesting. I always thought weight or fat distribution was more... not exact, but, spread out a little, at least, somewhat more and less concentrated. I'm not even sure how things concentrate into belly fat. But the last one about limiting TV viewing time, an effective strategy for weight reduction in adults and children. It seems like, duh, no-brainer. Yet at the same time, a lot of people watch TV. And a lot of people watching TV watch a lot of TV. And I think more of the population, is most of the population overweight? At least in America, maybe they are, but maybe not other places around the world. So I think you have to take a global look at this. And in that context, I think that probably diminishes the otherwise, duh aspect of this one. So I think that one might actually be the fiction. I'll go with Jay and Rebecca. I think this one's the fiction.
Okay. It seems that all of you agree that, according to recent research, those with a normal BMI but significant belly fat are at higher risk of cardiovascular death than those in the obese range of BMI. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Nice. Big shock there.
You're all safe so far. Now, yes, that's a little bit surprising to think that somebody with a normal BMI is at higher risk of cardiovascular death than those in the obese range of BMI. You might think, okay, overweight, okay, I'll buy that, but obese, that seems unusual. But, Rebecca is correct in that BMI, or body mass index, which is essentially a ratio of your height and your weight, it's a very crude measure, estimate, first approximation of how much fat you have. It's maybe useful statistically. I'm not one of those people who thinks that BMI is completely worthless. As a statistical tool, looking at large populations, it has some value. But it's not a great measure of body fat, especially when applied to individuals, because there are different body types. It doesn't take into consideration body type. Somebody who is mesomorphic and very muscular may be in the obese BMI range, even though they're very thin and they just have a lot of muscles. An ectomorph, somebody who's very thin and lanky, could have a gut on them and actually be in the normal BMI range, but because they're so tall and thin, but yet they still have this unhealthy fat around their abdomen. What this is really telling us is that the waist to hip ratio is a more effective measure of cardiovascular risk than BMI. That's how I interpret this study, because that's what they did. If you have people with a normal BMI but a high hip to waist ratio, belly fat, they were at higher risk of not only cardiovascular death but all mortality. People in the obese BMI range, which is probably a mix of people who are genuinely fat and those who are just bulky or muscular. And I do think that we're shifting towards using this hip to waist ratio as a better first approximation of being overweight, especially the truncal obesity, the unhealthy type of overweight, as opposed to people who are just endomorphs and just carry a lot of weight on them all over. If you have this specific kind of belly fat or truncal obesity, that seems to be the real risk factor for cardiovascular disease.
Endomorphs is a great word. I think people should rally around that.
You think
word.
So? Just like the word?
Yeah.
Steve, is that called android fat, the fat that's accumulated around your waist?
Well, it's a more male pattern, so that's where the word might come from. But yeah, let's go back to number one. Recent research suggests that good and bad dietary fat is determined by their effect on gut bacteria. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science. Sorry, Bob. This is interesting.
So LDL and HDL, that doesn't matter. Saturated fats just depends on your your gut bacteria.
It matters whether it's saturated or unsaturated, etc. But what makes saturated fat dangerous compared to unsaturated fat is its varying effects on the gut bacteria. That's why one type of fat is unhealthy. So it's still saying, yes, that the types of fat you thought were unhealthy are unhealthy, but it's not because, so the conventional thinking was certain kinds of fat lead to the deposit of fat and cholesterol on your arteries, like LDL sort of carries fat, you know, to your arteries, and HDL carries fat from your arteries to your liver. So it's removing fat from your arteries. So that's the conventional thinking as to why some fats are unhealthy and other fats are healthy. That's the good fat, bad fat thing. What this recent research is showing, this is coming from the University of Chicago. This research finds that maybe that it's what makes good fat is that it has a certain effect on bacteria in the gut, that it actually is antibacterial to a certain degree. Some types of lipids destabilize bacterial membranes. It may actually reduce overall bacteria, whereas other fats feed bad bacteria in your gut, and it increases those bacteria and has a negative effect on the balance of bacteria in your gut, which leads to, and this is the interesting part as far as I'm concerned, which leads to immune activation and chronic inflammation.
Wow.
What's interesting about that is that over one of the trends in research over the last 10 or 20 years has been the recognition that chronic inflammation is actually playing more of a significant role in vascular disease than was previously recognized. Maybe it's not so much about cholesterol buildup on the arteries, and et cetera. Maybe it's about inflammation in those arteries. In fact, there's a school of thought that aspirin is an effective preventer of strokes and heart attacks, not because of its antiplatelet effect, a blood-thinning effect, but because it's an anti-inflammatory, and it's inhibiting this chronic low-grade inflammation that's really the thing that's causing vascular disease, which is interesting. This research can sort of dovetail with that. You know, good fat, bad fat, maybe again it all comes back to inflammatory processes and not the way the body is handling the fat itself. So, you know, I'm personally not willing to abandon the whole fat hypothesis, you know, how your body handles the fat as opposed to what the fat's doing to your body. But I do think that the inflammation, chronic inflammation, is playing a large role, larger than we previously thought, in many interesting ways. And again, the other component now is the even more recent sort of paradigm shift is the thinking about the effects of the GI flora on our bodies, you know, on our health. And, you know, we're discovering that certain types of flora in the gut are correlate with obesity. Wouldn't that be interesting if it turned out that certain kinds of fat increased gut bacteria, which in turn caused obesity? Wouldn't that be interesting?
Maybe
it's just that certain kinds of fat cause obesity and also increase certain kinds of gut bacteria, and that's causing apparent causal relationship between gut bacteria and obesity, bringing us back to why it's difficult to interpret correlational evidence, because there's sometimes multiple complicated ways that you could draw those causal inferences. Very interesting. Hopefully in 5, 10, 20 years, we'll understand this a lot better, and that will give us more effective ways of reducing the risk of heart attacks and vascular disease, reducing obesity, etc. All right, which means that researchers find that limiting TV viewing time is an effective strategy for weight reduction in adults and children is the fiction. Does anybody want to guess what the key element of that?
Yeah. If you're not watching TV, what the hell are you doing?
Going on the computer?
Yeah. If you're sleeping,
you're not eating, guys. You're watching TV and you're eating.
If you're still not moving.
The thing that renders that, I admit this is tricky. This is one of my more tricky ones, was the adults. Mm. It's true for children, but not for adults.
Oh.
The effect was
I didn't think of that.
Was not significant in adults, but in teenagers, the effect was there. So what they did was they studied 153 adults and 72 adolescents for 1 year, giving them, you know, attachments to their TV that not only monitored, but regulated or reduced their TV allowance. And teenagers in households with reduced access to TV lost weight on average. There was a statistically significant effect, but not for the adults. It was not statistically significant.
I think it's because the adults were still spending all of their day in an office on a chair.
Yeah, I think I agree. I mean, I think with just the lifestyle of an adult is different, and access to TV isn't our problem. But with teenagers, they're either going to be crashing on the couch or they're outside playing. Although I would equate computer time with TV time.
Yeah.
They actually spend much more time in front of their computer screen than in front of the TV these days. But that's their sedentary activity. And when they're not doing that, they're generally out running around, burning off calories. So it is very important to limit screen time for kids and to keep them active. But adults, there are other things, I think, that dominate our lifestyle, not just our access to TV.
I would like to dedicate today's win to my friends Gary and Jeff. We were just talking about BMI the other day. And that led me to learn more about it and led me to win.
Cool.
So thank you, Gary. Gary is a listener of SGU. So thank you, Gary.
I would like to thank the random number generator. Today's victory.
Thank you, random number generator.
Whatever.
Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us today?
I have two quotes.
Cool.
And they're both from Neil Armstrong. The first quote is, "This is one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind." You know, it's for a man, for a man, you know, that whole thing.
Yeah.
Where he didn't say it the way he wanted to.
Yeah, the lost word.
Lost A.
Yeah.
Yeah, he blew it, but I could deal with it.
Made it more poetic.
No, it is, it actually, for some reason, it does sound more poetic.
Oh, bullshit.
Still, you know, listening to him say that and with the beeps, you know, that NASA beep noise when they initiate communication, and it's so ingrained in my head. You know, I'm sure most people feel that way, but that really is a powerful thing for me to listen to. I always get thrilled when I hear it. The second quote is one that you may not have heard, and I find this one to be also incredibly poetic. He said, "Mystery creates wonder, and wonder is the basis of man's desire to understand." Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much to a wonderful person that inspired more than one generation.
Neil Armstrong!
I have a question about the dropped A, because I have long heard that he didn't drop it, but that it was just
a recording flub of some kind.
Yeah.
No, we talked about that a while back. They did a serious analysis of the recording a while back, and they determined that yes, he did drop it, and even he for years was adamant that he did say it, but eventually he did say, yeah, after looking at it really closely, he's like, yeah, I guess I did drop the A.
I have an announcement. I
my gasp every other week when you say
you're changing the color of your hair.
I am, actually. I'm hoping to do it before Dragon Con, but also as we mentioned on a previous episode, we will all be podcasting live from SciCon in Nashville, October 26th through 28th, and in order to get to Nashville, I am going to be driving, and I'm going to be driving with my two very good friends, Richard Wiseman and John Ronson. We are going on a paranormal road trip sponsored by CFI and SciCon from CFI headquarters in Buffalo, New York, all the way down to Nashville, Tennessee. And we are asking you, our audience, to tell us where to go. Not like that. Get your minds out of the gutter.
Yeah, right.
But if you can think of a weird museum, a cool roadside attraction, a haunted house, anything like that, or if you want to help arrange for a public event where we will all hang out and chat, you can do that as well. And you can find out more at paranormalroadtrip.org.
Is the Creation Museum on the way?
There are a few on the way. We've already gotten a couple of people write it in with some tips on create. There's one Creation Museum, and there's one thing called a dinosaur walk, I think. That's like a Bible walk. That's apparently completely ridiculous. So I think we might try to hit those.
Cool. Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
If only I didn't have a life, I'd be going with you.
Next year.
Next year. Yeah.
Why, is Steve going to go on like a drinking bender? And, next
year. It could happen. It could happen.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me this week, everyone.
Thanks,
hey,
Steve.
You're welcome.
It's a good week.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.